Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy the show today. In today's show, we're going to have part one of a two-part presentation of the story that first ran on July 1st of 2023 under the headline, Man Found Meteorite on His Neighbor's Land. The first part of the presentation is going to be about the Willamette meteorite, and tomorrow, in part two, we'll finish up with a roundup of other meteorites, including the other most famous one, the Port Orford meteorite, if it existed. But first, let's raise the curtains on the Ellis Hughes farm for the opening act in the Willamette meteorite saga. It was getting toward the end of the summer of 1902, and West Lynn resident Ellis Hughes was getting worried. His neighbor, William Dale, had traveled back to eastern Oregon to sell some land that he owned there. With the proceeds, Dale and Hughes planned to buy a piece of property next to the Hughes farm. This property belonged to the Oregon Iron and Steel Company, which wasn't really doing anything with it, and which Hughes was pretty sure they would be happy to sell. Unless, of course, they found out why he wanted to buy it. Because earlier in the summer, while trespassing on it, Hughes had stumbled across the biggest meteorite that has ever been found on American soil, before or since, lying half buried in a remote and thickly forested part of it. One imagines him gnawing at his fingernails, waiting to hear back from Dale, hoping it would happen before the property owner got wise or somebody else found the meteorite. He'd piled brush over it, but there was only so much you could do to hide a 16-ton hunk of extraterrestrial nickel iron. Sooner or later, someone was going to spot it, and his chance to nab it would be lost. Finally, realizing that Dale was not coming back, Hughes decided on another solution. Theft. He would simply load the 31,000-pound meteorite onto a wagon in the middle of the night and drag it three-quarters of a mile onto his property, where he would discover it later. Believe it or not, this harebrained scheme probably would have worked if Hughes had kept his mouth shut just a little bit longer. The meteorite is known today as the Willamette meteorite. It's named after the nearest town to the Hughes farm, which was the little town of Willamette. This has since become a neighborhood of West Lynn. When the Willamette meteorite struck the Earth millions of years ago, it almost certainly did not land anywhere near where Hughes found it. A rock that big hitting anywhere around West Lynn would have buried itself to bedrock in the deep Willamette Valley topsoil, never to be seen again. Scientists believe it came down somewhere in Montana or northern Idaho during the last ice age and embedded itself in a glacier. Then at the end of the ice age, the glacier melted, calving off icebergs into the massive inland sea that was Glacial Lake Missoula, which of course torrentially drained, icebergs and all, down the Columbia River during the Missoula floods. The theory is that an iceberg containing the meteorite floated to what's now West Lynn before melting and depositing its load gently on the ground there. And for the next few hundred centuries, there it sat. Native Americans, when they found it, recognized it as special. They gave it a name, Tomonawos, translated as visitor from the moon. I'm not sure who did that translation, and I'm not sure if it's accurate, but I've read it in several different places. I'm just a little skeptical of Native American translations from mainstream European American sources. Anyway, they used to dip their arrowheads in the rainwater that collected in its pockets. Hughes was out cutting firewood when he noticed it, an oddly shaped boulder, oddly colored like rusty iron. Could it, he wondered, be a piece of iron ore? He consulted his neighbor, William Dale, who came over with a rock hammer and tapped on the strange rock. Instead of the expected rocky chop, the hammer rang with a bell-like ting on impact. Dale and Hughes looked at each other. This wasn't iron ore. This was straight-up iron. And the only way iron appears naturally on the surface of the earth in pure form is when it falls from the sky. Now, to be precise, the meteorite is 91.65% iron, 7.88% nickel, 0.22% cobalt, and 0.09% phosphorus. So yeah, that's how Ellis Hughes learned that there was a massive, priceless visitor from outer space parked on his neighbor's land. The plan to steal the meteorite kicked off with Hughes and his wife and stepson cutting a wagon road through the woods to the site from their home. Next, Hughes built a super heavy-duty wheeled platform to put the meteorite on and a super heavy-duty capstan winch for his horse to drive. Using the winch with the help of his wife and stepson, and of course the horse, he managed to roll the massive thing onto the platform, whereupon anchoring the winch to a big tree in the general direction of home, he started using it to slowly drag the loaded wagon through the woods. Progress was excruciatingly slow. For days on end, the horse walked in circles around the capstan, winding a cable round a spindle and dragging the platform inch by inch along the road. The best day's progress was 150 feet. Later in the summer, unseasonably heavy rains turned the wagon road into a mud bog, and progress slowed to just a few feet per day. Finally, they had to stop and put down planks for the cart to run on. But finally, 3 months after they started, the Hughes family had their stolen meteorite safe and sound on their own ground. And this was the point at which a wiser man would have spent the winter carefully and painstakingly repairing the damage to the neighboring land, filling the crater out of which the meteor had been dug, maybe even planting some small trees and shrubs in the wagon path. A year's wait with some careful cultivation would have gone a long way toward making the casual observer think nothing had happened there. But of course, that's not what Ellis Hughes did. Instead, he built a gazebo over the meteorite and started charging people 25 cents a head, which is $9 in modern money, to come and see it. The meteorite was a big sensation, and for a few weeks it was the talk of the town. It was, as Hughes rightly asserted, the biggest meteorite ever found in the U.S., at the time the third biggest in the world. Very soon, though, rumors started to circulate that Hughes had not found the meteorite on his own land. When these rumors reached the ears of the Oregon Iron and Steel Company people, they apparently went into the woods to look for evidence. And, of course, they found plenty of it. So they started off by offering to buy the meteorite from Hughes for $50, basically reimbursing him for the expense of dragging it out of the woods. But Hughes said no, so the company sued him, demanding its return. In court, Hughes argued that the meteorite was not real estate belonging to the land, it was personal property belonging to the Native Americans. Presumably he was working with the Indians at this point and probably had made some sort of deal with them because two tribal leaders from the Clackamas Indians testified on his behalf. The meteorite, they told the judge, was theirs, a holy object belonging to the Clackamas people. It was a surprisingly plausible argument, and in a modern court of law it would probably be a no-brainer. After all, if the president of Oregon Iron and Steel left his briefcase behind after a visit to a Clackamas village, they wouldn't be allowed to keep it based on a claim to have found it on their land. But not in 1903. The court promptly awarded the disputed meteorite to Oregon Iron and Steel, and when Hughes and the tribe appealed to the state Supreme Court, the decision was affirmed. The victorious company, possibly feeling some pressure from the tribe, announced that the meteorite would remain in Oregon forever and prominently featured the big space rock at the 1905 Lewis and Clark Centennial Exposition. But following a grand old tradition of dealing with Indian tribes in bad faith, when after the exposition ended, wealthy philanthropist Sarah Dodge offered to buy it for the American Museum of National History in New York City for $20,600. By the way, that's almost $700,000 in modern currency. Faced with that temptation, the company apparently changed their mind, took the money, and handed the tribes the mitten. And the Willamette meteorite has remained on display in the museum in New York City ever since. There are two replicas of it, one at the United Methodist Church in West Lynn, near where it was found, and the other outside the University of Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History in Eugene. But Oregonians who want to see the real thing will have to travel to New York to do it. In 1990, local Indian tribes sued for the return of the meteorite, but 10 years later they came to an agreement with the museum that lets them come and visit the meteorite and hold private ceremonies around it. The agreement also stipulates that if the museum ever takes it off permanent display, the tribes will get it back. Everyone seems to have been happy with this compromise, and when, in 2007, a bill got introduced in the Oregon House of Representatives demanding its return, the tribes released a statement saying they were happy with the existing arrangement and did not support the bill, and that no one had even bothered to talk to them about it before demanding the space rock's return. So, as Willamette Week put it in an editorial that year, neither the bill nor the 16-ton meteorite went anywhere. Well, that pretty much finishes off the story of Oregon's most famous meteorite. Its most famous real meteorite, that is. Tomorrow, in part two of this two-part presentation of the story, we'll talk about some of the other Oregon meteorites that have been found in the Beaver State, including one that may actually be more famous than the Willamette meteorite, but also is probably not real. That's coming up tomorrow on Offbeat Oregon History. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible through our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.